Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am covering in this audio Leviticus chapter 20, verses 1 through 27, covering child sacrifice and sexual immorality, Molech worship, in other words, and spiritism, family and sexual offenses, and finally we'll finish off with an appeal to holiness. We start now, well, our context is this. In our last chapter, Leviticus 19, we looked at miscellaneous laws, and now this chapter is somewhat miscellaneous too. We start with Leviticus 20, verses 1 through 5. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "You shall also say to the sons of Israel, any man from the sons of Israel or from the aliens sojourning in Israel who gives any of his offspring to Molech shall surely be put to death. The people of the land shall stone him with stones. I will also set my face against that man and will cut him off from among his people, because he has given some of his offspring to Molech, so as to defile my sanctuary and to profane my holy name. If the people of the land, however, should ever disregard that man when he gives any of his offspring to Molech, so as not to put him to death, then I myself will set my face against that man and against his family, and I will cut off from among their people both him and all those who play the harlot after him by playing the harlot after Molech." Now the Lord is still speaking to Moses in front of the tent of meeting. Way back in the first chapter, he started doing that, and he's still doing it. So all of these are laws that are given in advance of the Israelites trip through the wilderness into the Holy Land. Sometimes he speaks to Moses, sometimes speaks to Moses in there, and most of the time he just speaks to Moses, and we assume that Moses then passes the information along to Aaron. Now notice that the instructions are given not only to the sons of Israel, but also to the aliens sojourning in Israel. The sojourners, as the King James has it, the aliens, those aliens of the gate, or proselytes of the gate, people doing business in Israel and keeping the basic fundamental moral laws of the Old Testament, but not really going into circumcision and keeping all the festivals and so forth. And then the proselytes of righteousness, who were basically Jews who were not born in Israel. So all the laws applied to everybody, native and alien alike. Now any one of these sons of Israel or proselytes or alien who gives his offspring to Molech. Now that sounds like child sacrifice, and most people take it that way, but some say that the children were not sacrificed. Rather, they passed through the fire without killing them. King James has passed through. Here's how Jameson Fawcett Brown describes it. His, Molech's, statue was of brass and rested on a pedestal or throne of the same metal. His head, resembling that of a calf, was adorned with a crown, and his arms were extended in the attitude of embracing those who approached him. His devotees dedicated their children to him, and when this was to be done, they heated the statue to a high pitch of intensity by a fire within. And then the infants were either shaken over the flames or passed through the ignited arms by way of lustration to ensure the favor of the pretended deity. In other words, the fire that is coming up on top of the arms there, and the devotee just takes the baby and pushes him through the arms in the air. It doesn't really actually burn him up. Here's what John Gill has to say about that. Yet this seems to be something short of that. In other words, short of burning up the baby in the fire, and was to be done in this manner, as Jarchi and other Jewish writers relate, who say, "The father delivered his son to the priest of Molech, and they made two great fires, and caused the son to pass on foot between the two fires," which was a kind of lustration. A lustration is an expiatory sacrifice by burning. "And so of a dedication of them to the idol, though it must be owned that both were done," yes, that both the phrases of that should be the phases, not the phrases. "Both the phases of passing through the fire and of burning are used promiscuously of the same. And they might be both done at different times, or the one previous and in order to the other. Or perhaps they might cause the child so often and so long to pass through the fire as that at last was burnt and destroyed." Well, it just shows that the commentators are not really sure what went on in the worship of Molech. Gill says maybe they just built, the priest of Molech just built two fires and the babies were just passed between the two fires. Not two fires on the idol itself, but two fires in the grounds around the idol. Here's another comment from Jameson Fawcett and Brown. "But others suppose the children were not burnt, but only passed through the fire or between two fires by way of consecration to him. That some were actually burnt alive to this idol, several scriptures, according to the opinion of commentators, seem strongly to intimate." So we have, and he quotes three Old Testament scriptures. They intimate, but they don't prove it. "That others were only consecrated to his service by passing between two fires, the rabbis strongly assert." And if Ahaz had but one son, Hezekiah, he is said to have passed through the fire to Molech in 2 Kings 16:3. Yet he succeeded his father in the kingdom. Ooh, that's a good scriptural argument. You pass through the fire, but you're still alive so you can be a king. Therefore, this could only be a consecration. His idolatrous father intended thereby to initiate him early into the service of this demon. So we see there's pretty strong evidence that offering a child to Molech was not necessarily human live sacrifice. But it's still bad because you're offering your child to a pagan demon. Here's what Adam Clark has to say about passing through the fire of Molech. The rabbis describe this idol, who was probably a representative or emblematical personification of the solar influence, as made of brass in the form of a man with the head of an ox, that a fire was kindled in the inside, and the child to be sacrificed to him was put in his arms and roasted to death. Others say that the idol, which was hollow, was divided into 7 compartments within, and one of which they put flour, in the second turtle doves, in the third a ewe, in the fourth a ram, in the fifth a calf, in the sixth an ox, and in the seventh a child, and that must have been one bodaciously big idol, which, by heating the statue on the ice outside, were all burnt alive together. I question the whole truth of these statements, whether from Jewish or Christian rabbis. There is no evidence of all this in the sacred writings, and there is but presumptive proof, and not very strong, that human sacrifices were at all offered to Molech by the Jews. The passing through the fire, so frequently spoken of, might mean no more than a simple rite of consecration to the service of this idol. Probably a kind of ordeal was meant. The persons passing suddenly through the flame of a large fire, by which, though they might be burnt or scorched, they were neither killed nor consumed. Or they might have passed between 2 large fires as a sort of purification. So you see, there's a lot of skeptical, scholarly doubt over whether the Israelites or the pagans were actually devoting their offspring to Molech physically as a live sacrifice. Now, the penalty for passing your child through the fire to Molech was death. Whether the child was burnt or not, it didn't matter. Your death. People of the land shall stone him with stones. Now, this death penalty will be mentioned all the way through chapter 20. In fact, many of the sins that are listed in chapter 20 are also listed in chapter 18 and mentioned also. But the difference is in chapter 20, we see the death penalty, and not just cutting off, which is ambiguous, either exile or death penalty, but actually the death penalty is attached. And that's why when you realize that, that's why I think most of the time when you see cut off in the Old Testament law, it's talking about capital punishment. It's not talking about banishment. Now let's talk about, you shall stone him with stone, this child sacrificer to Molech. Here's the procedure as mentioned by Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. Quote, criminals who were condemned to be stoned were led with their hands bound without the gate to a small eminence where was a large stone placed at the bottom. When they had approached within 10 cubits of the spot, they were exhorted to confess that by faith and repentance their souls might be saved. When led forward to within 4 cubits, they were stripped almost naked and received some stupefying draught, during which the witnesses prepared, by laying aside their outer garments, to carry into execution the capital sentence which the law bound them to do. The criminal, being placed on the edge of the precipice, was then pushed backwards so that he fell down the perpendicular height on the stone lying below. If not killed by the fall, the second witness dashed a large stone down upon his breast, and then the people of the land, who were bystanders, rushed forward and with stones completed the work. That's a pretty gruesome procedure. Notice how in Matthew 21:44, Jesus' words seem to reflect this procedure. Quote, and he who falls on this stone will be broken to pieces, but on whomever it falls, it will scatter him like dust. He who falls on this stone, that would refer to the person falling off the little hill, going down the cliff and landing on the stone that's below, falling on the stone, and your body is broken to pieces. But on whomever it falls, and of course the rock here is talking about Jesus, metaphorically. So you're broken when you fall on Jesus, and then on whomever it falls, the rock of Jesus then falls from the cliff at the top as your fellow countrymen drop the rocks on top of you to finish you off in case you live. And so on whomever this rock falls, it will scatter him like dust. Of course, that's what happens to somebody that's wounded at the bottom of the cliff and a big rock falls on him. That's a pretty gruesome metaphor. It's a good verse to think about all those who think that little Jesus is just little Jesus, meek and mild, the little Christ child lying in the manger in Bethlehem. He's also an angry judge when he comes to contemplate sin And that's why people would do a lot better to fear him than to ignore him. Now, verse 3 says the child sacrificer will be cut off. I will cut him off. In this case, it's talking about death, because death is explicitly mentioned in verse 2. He shall surely be put to death. So there's no ambiguity there. Cut off does not mean exile. It means capital punishment. Now, at the end of verse 3, we see that the child sacrificer should be cut off because he has given some of his offspring to Molech so as to defile my sanctuary. Well, how is offering a child to Molech, which is a pagan idol somewhere away from the sanctuary, how does that defile the sanctuary? It seems like it would defile the offeror, of course. Well, the answer to that is if an Israelite offers his child to Molech and then comes in to offer his sacrifices in the tabernacle, which of course would happen a good bit every time you do a peace offering or whatever, you've defiled the temple just by coming into it. Now notice in verse 5 that if the people of the land disregard the one who offers a sacrifice to Molech, then I myself, God says, will set my face against that man, and I will cut him off. In other words, God will supernaturally kill him directly if the legal authorities don't do it. I myself will set my face against that man. Now, who is that man? Is it the man who disregards the child sacrificer, the child sacrifice? Or is it against the one doing the child sacrifice? I think it's more likely going to be the one that's doing the child sacrifice. John Gill leaves the possibility that it might be the person who's ignoring the legal procedure that should have been done, but I don't think so. I think he's talking about the one who's actually offering a child to Molech. Now notice that not only the one who offers his child to Molech is cut off and killed, but also his family. Well, first of all, what does family mean? Here are four options. It can mean his posterity. According to Matthew Poole, that's what the Hebrew word can mean. His posterity are going to be cut off. That's kind of loose, because posterity can go down to great-grandkids and great-great-grandkids. I don't think that's the answer. The family of the child sacrificer could refer to the people of the child sacrificer. In other words, the people of the land, the fellow Jews. Let's look at the King James translation of our verse 5 here. Then I will set my face against that man and against his family, and will cut him off, and all that go a-whoring after him to commit whoredom with Molech from among their people. In other words, the King James translates it this way. There are people amongst the Jews who do Molech sacrifice, and I will set my face against that man and against his family, the people of the land. In other words, the face is set against the child sacrificer and against the people of the land, and then I will cut him off, the child sacrificer, but not the people of the land. And the King James translation is necessary if you're going to believe that, because otherwise you're going to say God's going to kill the child sacrificer and he's going to kill all the Jews. Well, obviously not. The King James translates in a way such that the setting of the face is against the man and all the people, and the actual cutting off, the execution, is only against the child sacrificer. Well, I think that's a stretch, in my opinion. Third option of who this family is that gets punished along with the child sacrificer is the disciples or the followers of the child sacrificer. I think that's weak too. Here's the fourth option, and I think this is the correct option. His current family members. That's what it sounds like, right? God's going to cut off the child sacrificer and his family. Well, that's his brothers, his sisters, his mother, his father. So now, well, let me give you two commentators who agree with that view. Here's Ellicott, quote, because they would naturally be privy to it, the family members would, and aid and abet the father in this crime. They, as well as those who joined in this idolatrous worship, will be cut off by God himself. Here's what John Gill says. And against his family, either the family of the witness who could and should have testified against him, I've already mentioned that Gill gives that as a possibility, which I disagree with, or the judge negligent of his office. Okay, that's the negligent legal officials. But it could mean, Gill goes on to say, the cutting off is of the man himself, the child sacrificer himself, whose family must be privy to so shocking an action and were abettors of it and aiders and assisters in it. And so Achelaus renders it and his helpers. Well, I'm going to assume that the family of the child sacrificer is going to be cut off by God. And then I have another problem. What happened to individual justice? I mean, it was the child sacrificer who put that baby up there on the arms of Molech. It wasn't the child sacrificer's family. Well, what's the answer to that? Well, I'm sure the law assumes the family member was guilty, as these quotes from Ellicott and Gill I just gave you. The family would naturally be privy to the sinful action, and they would aid and abet the father in this crime. John Gill says the family must be privy to so shocking an action and were abettors of it and aiders and assisters in it. So I believe that that's probably what's going on here. The family is to be executed because they were involved in the child sacrifice. I do not believe that the family member would be executed if he didn't have anything to do with the child sacrifice. However, I think that's reading too much in the law and being unfair to the text. Let's go down to Leviticus 20, verses 6 through 8. As for the person who turns to mediums and to spiritists to play the harlot after them, I will also set my face against that person and will cut him off from among his people. You shall consecrate yourselves, therefore, and be holy, for I am the Lord your God. You shall keep my statutes and practice them. I am the Lord who sanctifies you. And of course, sanctifies means to make you holy. And holy means separated from the world and consecrated to God. And which, of course, is the theme of Leviticus, as I've said many times before. Now, this person who turns to mediums and spiritists, that's the person who's consulting the medium. So consulting a medium was just as culpable as being a medium, as the NIV Study Bible says. Leviticus 19:31 says, do not turn to, consult. Mediums or spiritists, do not seek them out to be defiled by them. I'm the Lord your God. That's the previous chapter. Later on in this chapter, we will read in verse 27, Leviticus 20, now a man or a woman who is a medium or a spiritist shall surely be put to death. They shall be stoned with stones. Their blood guiltiness is upon them. It's also this prohibition, this stricture against spiritists is also mentioned in Deuteronomy 18, verses 10 through 11. There shall not be found among you anyone who makes his son or his daughter pass through the fire, one who uses divination, one who practices witchcraft, or one who interprets omens, or a sorcerer, or one who casts a spell, or a medium, or a spiritist, or one who calls up the dead. Bunch of different names for the same old demon activity, and they're still around today, and they've got several names, but they all doing the same thing. Communicating with the devil and his demons. In verse 8, God tells Moses to tell the people, you shall keep my statutes. Now, the statutes are plenty, as we see in the Torah and the Pentateuch. Jameson Fossum Brown says this about that, quote, the minute specification of the incestuous and unnatural crimes here enumerated, that's coming up, shows their sad prevalence among the idolatrous nations around and the extreme proneness of the Israelites to follow the customs of their neighbors. Yeah, there are some really gross crimes here mentioned. And if we have the mistaken notion that the modern world is more civilized than back then or that the ancient world is more sinless than the world today, however you want to look at it, no, man's always been the same. There's nothing new under the sun. Same old sexual perversions that they have now that they have back then. Verse 8, God contrasts himself with all the pagan neighbors around the Israelites. He says, I am the Lord who sanctifies you. Now, the NIV Study Bible says that all the way through chapters 18 through 26, you see that phrase over and over again, God saying, I am the Lord who sanctifies you. I am the Lord who sanctifies you. You want to follow Yahweh, you better be holy like Yahweh is. Be you holy as I am holy. We go down to Leviticus 20, verse 9. If there is anyone who curses his father or his mother, he shall surely be put to death. He has cursed his father or his mother. His blood guiltiness is upon him. This legal prohibition of cursing one's parents is repeated in Deuteronomy 21, 20 through 21. They shall say to the elders of his city, this son of ours, the parents shall say this son of ours is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey us. He is a glutton and a drunkard. Then all the men of his city shall stone him to death. So you shall remove the evil from your midst, and all Israel will hear of it and fear. Now, I'm assuming this is an extreme case of rebellion, not just because he's a glutton and a drunkard. That's just a description of him in general, but he's probably also terrorizing his parents and perhaps terrorizing his neighbors too. Remember, they didn't have a police force back then. And so anybody that would disrespect his parents to that extent will suffer the extreme penalty. That doesn't bother me. It used to bother me, not anymore. Be a great object lesson. It's probably rarely carried out because any son who knew he was going to rebel that much against his father, he would know the consequences. And so he would know that the father, all he's got to do is bring him before the gates and say, this son is ungovernable, unmanageable, and he needs to be punished. And that son will be in a world of trouble. So there was probably very little rebellion against parents in the ancient Jewish society. Leviticus 19:3 in the previous chapter has the same idea. It says, every one of you shall reverence his mother and his father. That's the positive aspect of it. Leviticus 20 verse 9 is you don't curse father or mother. And Leviticus 19:3 gives the positive way of saying it. You shall reverence your mother and your father. There's another reason why the penalty was so strict. Israel was in a fragile position. We got 2 million people wandering through a desert. One flash flood could kill you, could wipe you out, or wipe out a good portion of you. You're being attacked by people like the Amalekites who track you and try to wipe you out. Tribal rebellions and power struggles over who's going to lead the clan, that could have destroyed the whole nation. And that's why the penalty was very, very strict. Says he shall be put to death, and that means by stoning, because that's the usual way, the typical way of carrying out capital punishment in Israel. Now, there is one exception to that we're going to look at in just a few verses. Leviticus 20:14, we'll see a man marrying his mother and her daughter. The two women and him shall be burned with fire. But that probably means the death was first inflicted by stoning and then the corpse burned. So we can say with a high degree of certainty that stoning was the method of execution in Israel. We go now to Leviticus 20:10. If there is a man who commits adultery with another man's wife, one who commits adultery with his friend's wife, the adulterer and the adulteress shall surely be put to death. This prohibition without the penalty is mentioned in Leviticus 18:20, 2 chapters previous. You shall not have intercourse with your neighbor's wife to be defiled with her. I mean, even in pagan Sodom and Gomorrah America, we know we're not supposed to do that. At least some of us do. Deuteronomy 22:24 says, then you shall bring them both out to the gate of that city, and you shall stone them to death. The girl, because she did not cry out in the city. If she cried out in the city, she was crying out for help because she was being raped. And of course, you're not going to execute a rape victim. But if she didn't cry out, that means, oh, she's getting it on and having a good time with it. And the man, because he has violated his neighbor's wife. Thus you shall purge the evil from among you. So, adultery in general was punished by death. And here's the prohibition against it in the Ten Commandments, Exodus 20:14, you shall not commit adultery. Well, that's easy enough. But the punishment's a little bit problematic here because the adulterer and the adulteress are put to death. However, in Leviticus 19, verse 20, in our previous chapter, we see that a certain kind of adulterer and adulteress were not put to death. Leviticus 19:20, if a man has sexual intercourse with a woman who is a slave designated for another man, designated probably means betrothed or engaged to, but she has not been redeemed or given her freedom. In other words, the redemption process has not been through. She hadn't been given her certificate of freedom yet. She's still a slave. There must be punishment. It doesn't say what punishment. They are not to be put to death because she has not been free. In other words, because she's a slave, the punishment for her adultery is not death. And as a matter of fact, the punishment for the man who commits adultery with her is not death. Now, what the punishment is, the Jewish rabbis, I think they were scourged. The man had to give a guilt offering, which was a minor punishment. And this presents problems, at least problems to me. Here's some options for the reason why the slave girl was not punished by death. Option number one, the man betrothed to the slave girl would lose his slave wife if she were executed through no fault of his own. Well, the problem with that argument, a counter to that argument is, well, a married man married to a free woman who commits adultery with another free man, that wife, that adulterous wife of his would be executed through no fault of his own. Here's a counter to that argument. Well, if a free woman commits adultery, she had to go along with it. If she didn't, it would be rape and these laws would not apply. So she voluntarily committed adultery. And what? That's not so great a loss to the husband to lose an adulterous wife, is it now? In fact, a lot of husbands who have an adulterous wife lose them through divorce. Not always, but I would say the majority of times, or many times. But on the other hand, if you got a slave wife who commits adultery, she could have been pushed to it because of her slave status. She doesn't have any power to resist. She can't say, she might be afraid to say, I'm going to tell my master. And the guy could say, I'm a master, what, so what? I'm his friend. Or he can't do anything to me. And the slave woman would be stuck because she has no power, and so therefore she shouldn't be punished, or at least not punished with death. She might be punished, but not ultimately punished. That's all my thinking. I can't find it. I don't know why the commentary seemed to have gone dark on that issue, because I looked through a ton of them and nobody wants to comment on it, at least not that I've been able to find. Well, anyway, that's why the slave girl might not have been punished by death, because she didn't have enough power to resist the blandishments of her adulterous suitor. Well, what I've just said might explain the difference between a free woman adulterer and a slave woman a free woman adulteress and a slave woman adulteress, but we still have the problem of the male adulterer. If a male adulterer has sex with a slave, he's not executed. Has sex with an engaged slave, he's not executed. Well, the only reason that I can have been able to discover that might explain that is he was probably a slave, because a slave would be having adultery with another slave, likely, and his execution would cause his owner financial loss, and the owner had not done anything to cause this adultery to happen. But that still doesn't answer the question is, what if a free man has sex with a slave who is engaged to somebody else, whether slave or free, whoever they're engaged to, I don't think would make much difference. Why isn't he punished? Is nobody coercing him to have adultery, to commit adultery? I'll have to leave that one up in the air because I couldn't find an answer to it. We go now to Leviticus 20, verses 11 through 13. If a man sleeps with his father's wife, he has shamed his father. Both of them must be put to death. Their blood is on their own hands. If a man sleeps with his daughter-in-law, both of them must be put to death. They have acted perversely. Their blood is on their own hands. If a man sleeps with a man as with a woman, they have both committed a detestable thing. That's homosexual sex there. They must be put to death. Their blood is on their own hands. Now, verse 11 says, if a man sleeps with his father's wife, the NIV says, dishonors his father's wife. Who is the father's wife? Well, it could be his stepmother or his blood mother. Well, you usually don't say if a man sleeps with his father's wife, referring to your blood mother. You would say if a man sleeps with your mother. You wouldn't say if a man sleeps with his father's wife. So we assume that's a stepmother. Well, a fortiori, if it's a sin and a shame to sleep with your stepmother, even more so, it's a sin and a shame to sleep with your blood mother. Now, there's some other issues here. How about the timing of this wife of the father? Let's say the father is alive and betrothed to this new wife, the future stepmother. Doesn't matter. Can't sleep with him, according to the Jewish rabbis. What if the father is alive and married to the stepmother? Well, that's obvious. That's wrong. But how about this? What if the father's dead and his surviving wife is still around, the stepmother? You still can't sleep with her. Verse 12 says you don't sleep with your daughter-in-law, or are both of you going to get killed, executed. This is a repeat of Leviticus 18:15, which has the crime but does not have the penalty. You are not to have sexual intercourse with your daughter-in-law. She is your son's wife. You are not to have sex with her. And likewise, with Jewish tradition, the timing of the relationship of father and daughter-in-law is irrelevant. Let's say the son is alive and betrothed to be married to a girl, and you have sex with that girl, even though she's not married. She is betrothed to your son. That's a no-no. Boom, you die, and so does she. According to Jewish tradition, and I think in this case, Jewish tradition is quite reasonable. And of course, if the son is alive and married, you have sex with your son's wife, boom, you both die. What if the son is dead and leaves a widow behind, and you have sex with a widow? You die. We go to Leviticus 20, verse 13. If a man sleeps with a man as with a woman, this is many in one of the many Old Testament prohibitions against homosexuality. As, for example, Leviticus 18:22, you shall not lie with the male as one lies with the female. It is an abomination. It doesn't say it is something to be proud of, as in a pride parade. It says it is an abomination. But, of course, the wussy-pussy evangelicals have got ways to explain it all away. I mean, the latest one I saw was when Paul in Romans 1 talked about all the terrible, abominable practices of homosexuality. According to this Yale historian, Paul was talking about a heterosexual who engaged in homosexual behavior, violating his nature. But if a homosexual is born that way, which he'll never be able to prove, has never been proven, but if let's just say, ad arguendo, that the homosexual is born that way, well, then he needs to live out his natural nature. In that case, it would be perfectly all right to get married, quote-unquote married, and have sex with another man, but not if he's a heterosexual. This is the sort of perverse idiotic, immoral, disgusting thinking that you find in the colleges of America today, of which you and I are paying their bills with all of our tax subsidies to these morons. We go now to Leviticus 20, verse 14. If there is a man who marries a woman and her mother, it is immorality. Both he and they shall be burned with fire, so that there will be no immorality in your midst. Now, there's two ways you could marry a woman and a mother. The woman and the mother could be alive at the same time, in which case you've just committed polygamy with a woman and her mother. Doesn't matter. That's a no-no. Burned with fire. Or you could marry a woman and her mother in another way, serially, after one of the women dies. Let's say the mother dies first. You marry the mother, she dies, and then you marry the daughter. Or, other way around, you marry the daughter, she dies, and then you marry the mother. You're toast. That's over. You're burned with fire. This prohibition against marrying a woman and her mother is repeated from Leviticus 18:17. You are not to have sexual intercourse with a woman and her daughter. You are not to marry her son's daughter or her daughter's daughter and have sex with her. So you see, the prohibition in Leviticus 18 was not only between you couldn't marry a woman and her daughter, but you couldn't marry a woman and her granddaughter. No punishment is mentioned in Leviticus 18, but it is mentioned here in Leviticus 20. The punishment is they shall be burned with fire, both the mother and the daughter, and the man who married them. Now, as Colin Delitzsch says, this burning with fire is probably the corpses are burned with fire after they are stoned, because stoning was the normal method of execution. Now, Jewish tradition has another way of executing people. John Gill cites this, quote, well, the people, the criminals, were, quote, burnt by pouring lead into their mouths. And so the manner of burning is described in the Mishnah. They are to be burnt. They that are to be burnt are fixed in dung up to their knees. Then they put a hard napkin within a soft one and roll it about his neck. One draws one way and another another way until he opens his mouth. Then they take hot melted lead and pour it into his mouth, which goes down into his bowels and burns them. Heck of a way to die. All for marrying a mother and a daughter. Family relations were important to the Old Testament law. Now, of course, that's just Jewish tradition. John Gill disagrees with that Jewish tradition. He says, nah, the guilty parties were burnt with faggots. But Colin Delitzsch said, no, they weren't burnt with faggots. They were stoned first, and their corpses were burnt. Here's another way they could possibly have been punished. This is from Adam Clark. They were branded. Here's Clark's arguments in favor of this proposition. He says, the first wife was innocent. Obviously, you marry a woman, she has a daughter. You haven't married the daughter yet, so the first wife is innocent, so why should she be stoned or burnt? Well, but the law here says the first wife is stoned just like the second wife is stoned. Excuse me, the first wife is burnt just like the second wife is burnt, i.e. branded according to this view. So the first wife would be branded even though she was innocent. Well, you might could argue, well, she should have raised serious objections to her husband. Ah, you can't marry my daughter, and she didn't, so therefore she deserves to be branded. Well, but the problem with that is, in a patriarchal society, how much veto power did the first wife have? How could she say to the husband, ah, you can't marry my daughter? I think that this law presumes collusion between the mother and the daughter, a chance to get themselves both taken care of financially. And so the mother says, hey, hubby, how about marrying my daughter? She's cute and sexy. No, no. Not supposed to do that. It's incest. I've never heard of that being done in modern times. I don't know if it'd be incest now or not. It ought to be if it's not. We go now to Leviticus 20, verses 15 through 16. If there is a man who lies with an animal, he shall surely be put to death. You shall also kill the animal. If there is a woman who approaches any animal to mate with it, you shall kill the woman and the animal. They shall surely be put to death. Their blood guiltiness is upon them. This repeats the law against bestiality in Leviticus 18, verse 23. Also, you shall not have intercourse with any animal to be defiled with it, nor shall any woman stand before an animal to mate with it. It is a perversion. Even today, it's, as of now, as I speak, it's a perversion. Maybe wait next week till the social justice warriors take over the whole culture completely. Maybe it'll be okay and we'll legalize it and have a animal pride month for animals having sex with humans. Why was the animal killed in verse 15? Well, here's some options. Option 1, so no reminder would be left of the sin that was committed. reasonable. John Gill's option one, option two from Gill. So the animal might not be used again in such sin. Reasonable. Kill an animal. Pretty soon it's going to be unusable. Third reason, perhaps, it would be an object lesson if everybody saw that the animal was put to death. And if an animal is put to death with such sin, a fortiori, how bad it must be for humans to do it. Well, that's true, but you already got the object lesson. The committer of bestiality has already been put to death. So that's just it just adds to the object lesson. You're going to do this kind of perversion, you're both going to die. Now, in verse 16, it says, their blood guiltiness is upon them. Does that refer to the animal and the man? No, it refers to the animal. It refers to the man. This is in verse 15. Can't mate with an animal. And verse 16, a woman is mating with an animal. Their blood guiltiness is upon them. That means both the woman and the man are guilty. Leviticus 20, verse 17, if a man marries his sister, whether his father's daughter or his mother's daughter, and they have sexual relations, it is a disgrace. They must be cut off publicly from their people. He has had sexual intercourse with his sister. He will bear his punishment. Now, when it says if a man marries his sister, I assume that's the umbrella term for all kinds of sisters. You can have full blood sisters, your normal sister, a sister that shares your mother and father. You could have a blood half-sister on your father's side, a sister who shares your father. Or you can have a sister, a half-blood sister on your mother's side, a sister who shares your mother, but you have different fathers. And that's not all. You could also have an adopted sister. Or you could have an adopted half-sister, either on your father's side or your mother's side. All kinds of possibilities, doesn't matter. I think that's what this word means, sister, period. All kinds of sisters. It could mean just your blood sister, but I don't think so. I think it means all sisters. You are guilty and you will bear your punishment, which of course in this chapter means death. This is a repeat of the law against incest with your sister in Leviticus 18:9. The nakedness of your sister, either your father's daughter or your mother's daughter, whether born at home or born outside, their nakedness you shall not uncover. That's the New American Standard Bible Translation. Let me give you the Holman Christian Standard Body Translation. The NASB is terrible on these sexual sin passages. The Holman Christian Standard Bible at Leviticus 18:9 says this, you are not to have sexual intercourse with your sister, either your father's daughter or your mother's, whether born at home or born elsewhere. You are not to have sex with her. Now, the born at home or born elsewhere, that's the born at home is probably a half-sister by the father who's taken a second wife in a polygamous relationship. Born elsewhere. Could mean a man who brings a daughter home from a deceased wife or maybe a divorced wife in a previous marriage and then comes into the home and brings the half-sister from outside. It doesn't matter. You're not to have sex with her. Now, it says if a man marries his sister, whether his father's daughter, that can mean a lot of things. It could mean a blood half-sister sharing a father. It could be an adopted half-sister sharing a father. Or it could be a full-blood sister sharing a father and a mother. I don't think it's a full-blood sister. You usually don't call your sister your father's daughter. So we can leave that one out, but could it be a blood half-sister or an adopted half-sister with whom the father is shared? Same with mother's daughter. They shall be cut off publicly from their people, and that, in this context of this chapter, is death. Let's go to Leviticus 20, verse 18. If a man sleeps with a menstruating woman and has sexual intercourse with her, he has exposed the source of her flow, and she has uncovered the source of her blood. Both of them must be cut off from their people. Now, menstruating woman, that was stated in the law to be a no-no to have sex with. Leviticus 15:19, when a woman has a discharge, if her discharge is in her body is blood, she shall continue in her menstrual impurity for 7 days, and whoever touches her shall be unclean until evening. Now, there's a problem here. You have sex with a woman in her menstrual impurity, you're unclean for 7 days. That's not being cut off and executed or even cut off and banished. It's just being unclean for 7 days. Well, that's because Leviticus 15:9 is talking about someone who has sex with a woman whose period starts in the middle of sex, and therefore the man didn't know she was having a period. It just happened. And so he's not punished for doing something. But Leviticus 18:19, you are not to come near a woman during her menstrual impurity to have sexual intercourse with her. That's when you know she's having a period. You're supposed to stay away. Leviticus 18:6 mentions this. This does not eat at the mountain shrines or lift up his eyes to the idols of the house of Israel or defile his neighbor's wife. And amidst all those sins, the last one is, or approach a woman during her menstrual period. That's a sin. Ezekiel 22:10, men within you have sexual intercourse with their father's wife. That's their stepmother's. And violate women during their menstrual impurity. All right, so it's very clear you weren't supposed to have sex with a woman menstruating, whether involuntarily or voluntarily. Now, what are some reasons why, or some options why, sex with menstruating women was considered a no-no, either ceremonially unclean or punishable by death? Well, Adam Clark's got an interesting idea. It was to protect offspring with disease. In other words, if you had sex with a woman in her period and the woman got pregnant, which is, by the way, highly unlikely. It is possible, but it's highly unlikely. Then that offspring would be some kind of abortion, some kind of monster, some kind of deformed creature. Here's Clark's quote. The common sense of all mankind has led them to avoid the gross impropriety referred to in this verse. In other words, most people don't have sex with their wife while they're menstruating. And it has been a general opinion that offspring obtained in this way has been infected with leprous, scrofulous, and other deeply eradicated diseases from which they and their posterity have been scarcely ever freed. Well, folks, that's ridiculous. That's not why they were supposed to stay away from menstruating women, the men. That's not why. It was to show respect for blood, since the whole Levitical system is based on blood sacrifices. Here's a quote. I've got a couple of good quotes about that. This is from an anonymous person on yahoo.com. Quote, it is important to remember the purpose of the Old Testament laws concerning blood in the sacrificial system. Blood was sacred, Leviticus 17:11. A woman's uncleanliness during her period was symbolic of the value placed on blood. Here's a good quote from gotquestions.org. As a result of these scriptures, some hold that a married couple should not have sex while the wife is having her period. The problem with this view is that if the scriptures are applied consistently, even touching a woman who is having her menstrual flow would be forbidden today. Couldn't touch your wife if she's having a period. Couldn't slap her on the back. Further, according to Leviticus 15:20-23, even touching something that the woman has also touched would be forbidden. Oh my gosh, can't sleep on the bed tonight. My wife's having a period. Do these laws apply to us today? No, they do not. Why? It is important to remember the purpose of the Old Testament laws concerning blood. In the sacrificial system, blood was sacred. Again, quoting our favorite verse here, Leviticus 17:11, which says the life is in the blood. A woman's uncleanness during her period was symbolic of the value placed on blood. As a result, contact with a woman who was having her period was forbidden. Christians today are not under the Old Testament ceremonial law. There no longer is a sacrificial system. Jesus' blood sacrifice paid the penalty for sins once and for all. The Levitical ceremonial laws do not apply today. There is no biblical reason why a married couple cannot have sex during the wife's period. Thank you, gotquestions.org. I remember that question was asked of somebody doing a natural family planning course, a friend of mine, and there was a chart there that showed that a husband had had sex with his wife during her period, and a woman in the audience got all bent out of shape saying, why don't you condemn this? This is sin. This is awful. The Bible says you can't do that. Well, no, the Bible doesn't say that. We go to Leviticus 20, verses 19 through 21. You must not have sexual intercourse with your mother's sister or your father's sister. That's your aunt, paternal, your maternal aunt, and your paternal aunt, for it is exposing one's own blood relative. Both people will bear their punishment. Well, even today, that's a no-no, not marrying your aunt. If a man sleeps with his aunt, he has shamed his uncle. They will bear their guilt and die childless. Now, by the way, before this, Amram married Jochebed. Amram was Moses' father, and Amram was the nephew of Jochebed. Jochebed was his aunt. But that was before the law. Bigger gene pool then. Now we got problems with interbreeding here, and so the laws of consanguinity are going to stop you from having sex with your aunt. If a man sleeps with his aunt, he has shamed his uncle. They will bear their guilt and die childless. If a man marries his brother's wife, and then we're switching from aunts to sister-in-laws, it is impurity. He has shamed his brother. They will be childless. Now, once again, we see this is a repetition of the same law in Leviticus 18, verse 14. You are not to shame your father's brother by coming near his wife to have sexual intercourse. She is your aunt. Now, John Gill adds this prohibition applies whether the uncle is alive or dead. If your uncle has a widow, you can't marry the widow. Now, verse 21, we go to the sister-in-law. That's again a repeat of the prohibition against having sex with your brother-in-law in Leviticus 18:16. You're not to have sexual intercourse with your brother's wife. It will shame your brother. Now, the Levirate marriage law was an exception to this. You could marry your brother's wife if your brother died childless and the wife had no one to maintain the family, and so all of her possessions would pass out of her family, and she needed to have an offspring and a descendants. And so then the brother not only was allowed to marry his brother's wife, he was required to marry his brother's wife. Now, the punishment for sleeping with your aunt or your sister-in-law, the punishment was you die childless. And what does that mean? Well, here's option number one. It means that the incestuous couple would be buried after their children from a previous marriage had died, and so they die childless. Or could they shall be buried before the children that the incestuous couple had together, before they had children together, before they could get pregnant and have kids, and so they die childless. That's either naturally or by the children would either die naturally, or it could be a judgment of God on the incestuous couple not to have children in the first place. Third option is they could physically have an offspring, a child, but the incestuous couple's children would be spurious, denied by human authority the ordinary privileges of the children of Israel, because the government officials could say, nah, those are not really children. They were born of an incestuous union. They're going to be illegitimate with a capital I, so you don't really have children. They will become wards of the state, to use modern terminology. Well, I don't know what it means, but the punishment for this is you don't have children. And of course, that was a big punishment back then because the Israelites, especially the women, did they want to have children? We go now to verses 22 through 26, Leviticus 20. You are therefore to keep all my statutes and all my ordinances and do them, so that the land to which I am bringing you to live will not spew you out. Moreover, you shall not follow the customs of the nation which I will drive out before you, for they did all these things, and therefore I have abhorred them. Hence I have said to you, you are to possess their land, and I myself will give it to you to possess it, a land flowing with milk and honey. I am the Lord your God who has separated you from the peoples. You are therefore to make a distinction between the clean animal and the unclean, and between the unclean bird and the clean. And you shall not make yourselves detestable by animal or by bird or by anything that creeps on the ground, which I have separated for you as unclean. Thus you are to be holy to me, for I the Lord am holy, and I have set you apart from the peoples to be mine. Now verse 22, where God tells Moses to tell the people to keep all of his statutes, that means not only the ones in this chapter, but the whole book of Leviticus. Now, if you do that, God won't spew you out. And of course, the converse of that is if you do all these immoral and disgusting things and unholy things, God will spew you out of the land, which is exactly what happened to Israel in 722 and 586 BC. 10 northern nations in 722, the Assyrians spewed them out or booted them out. And in 586 BC, the Babylonians got the two southern tribes. This spewing out punishment is, again, another repeat from Leviticus 18, verse 25. For the land has become defiled, therefore I have brought its punishment upon it, so the land has spewed out its inhabitants. John Gill says, the stomach does this when that which it contains is loathsome. You vomit. And basically, the land of Israel, the land of Canaan, would vomit because it would be so disgusted with what it had to put up within it. Now, verse 23, it says, you shall not follow the customs of the nation which I will drive out. Actually, there were lots of nations. Nation means tribes, bunch of Canaanite tribes. And so John Gill tries to explain that by saying this singular nation seems to be put for nations plural. In other words, it's just a way of referring to all the Canaanites in general. Follow the customs of the nation, just lumping them all together and call them Canaanites. That's easy enough. Some say it refers to the Amorites, which was the principal nation of the seven. They were very famous Amorites. They were a huge tribe. In fact, they went beyond the promised land, all up into Syria and into the Fertile Crescent, mentioned on the old ancient Egyptian and ancient Near Eastern archaeological remains, letters, tablets. And so it could be the nation was referring to the Amorites. Again, as a general term for all the seven tribes, it doesn't really make any difference. Now, verse 24, God says, you are to possess the land. I will give it to you to possess it. Did they possess it? Well, actually, yes. Joshua 21:43. So the Lord gave Israel all the land he had sworn to give their fathers. All the land, not some of it, all of it. And they took possession of it and settled there. Now, it took them a while, but they eventually got it all. By the time we get to Solomon's rule, which was about 10th century BC, 1 Kings 4:21, Solomon ruled over all the kingdoms from the Euphrates River to the land of the Philistines and as far as the border of Egypt. Euphrates River is up in Syria to the northeast. The land of the Philistines is on the Mediterranean coast to the west. As far as the border of Egypt, that's to the southwest. Solomon ruled over it all. They got it all. Now, that has theological implications for those who like to focus on the fact that the promises are supposedly supporting to Prime Minister Netanyahu's, or at least he was Prime Minister, to his land over there in Israel, that geopolitical entity that got formed in 1948. But it could be, I submit to you, that this prophecy in the law here, that I'm giving you the land to possess, it's already been fulfilled. They already possess the land. And maybe God was aiming at something else. Maybe he was not, when he gave all those prophecies about Israel coming back to the land, he's using that as a type to refer to the church of Jesus Christ as myriad upon myriad of Christians coming to the kingdom. A lot of theology there. Now you go into this land, the physical land now, in verse 24, it is a land of milk and honey because there were lots of cows and sheep and goats, and cows and sheep and goats make milk. That's why it's called a land of milk. It's a land of honey because there were lots of bees. So it became a proverbial expression meaning a prosperous land. Now in verse 24, God says, I am the Lord your God who has separated you from the peoples. Now remember, holy means separate from the world and consecrated to God. So when he says separate from the people, that's just one of the main themes of Leviticus, because that's talking about holiness. I made you holy, separate from the people. Verse 25 says that you need to make distinctions between clean and unclean animals, just like the book of Leviticus says, and you shall not make yourself detestable by animal or by bird or by anything that creeps on the ground. Don't make yourself detestable. That's a strong word. Oh, big mosquito just flew by my computer screen, scared me to death right when I said detestable. That is a swarming thing. Leviticus 11:43, do not render yourselves detestable through any of the swarming things that swarm, and you shall not make yourselves unclean with them so that you become unclean. So detestable is a little bit stronger than unclean, but both words are used. Leviticus 20, verse 27, will finish up this chapter. Now a man or a woman who is a medium or a spiritist shall surely be put to death. They shall be stoned with stones. Their blood guiltiness is upon them. Now, usually the law is given from the point of view of a man committing crimes. You have to reason to the woman committing the crime. She will get the same punishment, but the woman is not mentioned. And I think there's a reason for that, is it's real hard to express crimes using both genders. Now, sometimes the gender makes a difference, of course, but most of the time it doesn't. And so what's the point of repeating? So you just say the man, the judge will reason from the prohibition against the man to a prohibition against the woman. But now here a woman is explicitly mentioned, and it's really unnecessary because it doesn't matter whether the medium or spiritist is a man or a woman. Well, why would the woman be mentioned here? John Gill suggests that it's because women were often more inclined than men to practice sorcery, and that's true. I mean, we hear about witches a lot more than warlocks. You look at the Red Hand ladies, like in my hometown there used to be Red Hand ladies. They were always women. You look in the movies, you know, you go into these tents where they have the stars around and the wizards and the crystal balls and the tarot cards. It's almost always women. So that's probably why. Now, another interesting question is, why is it mostly women to do all this stuff? That's not universal. Look at the New Age. I've looked at a lot of New Age people who've come out of it and come into Christianity YouTube videos, and most of them are women. There's one man that's particularly good, a young man, but lots of them are women. Why? I mean, I haven't proven that the majority of spiritists are women. I don't know that that's the case. It just seems to be the case from my perhaps limited observations. But why would that be a woman be more interested in this kind of stuff? Well, I've often heard that women are more spiritually intuitive than men. And I believe that's true. Go to marriage seminars. They always talk about how women say, a man husband will look at his wife and say, you're so irrational. And the woman just has got a gut feeling about that guy that her husband wants to go into business with. She can't put her finger on it, but by golly, she's right as rain, even though she can't explain it. That happens all the time. And I think it's true. It's not a unjustified stereotype, but I think it's true that women tend to be more spiritually attuned to spiritual things than men are. And so if they're more spiritually attuned to the Holy Spirit, that means they probably could be more spiritually attuned to demon spirits. Now, notice that this is a punishment against someone who is a medium. We've already mentioned earlier in this chapter that you could consult a medium and be just as guilty, verse 6, Leviticus 20, as for the person who turns to mediums and to spiritists to play the harlot after them. I will cut him off. I've already mentioned those scriptures earlier, so I'll stop it right there. And we are now prepared to go to Leviticus chapter 21 in our next audio. In that chapter, verses 1 through 29, we will discuss how to keep a priest holy. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you've enjoyed this one.